The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. We've been talking on our last program about some of the roundworms, the pseudocoelomates. Part of the reason for taking this time is simply to look at examples of the types of organisms, and if you were able to see pictures of them. I happen to have my invertebrate zootext here, so I can flip from one page to another and see pictures of each of these types of worms. You would see that they're very, very different, different in size, different in structure in some cases. And in passing, I would remind you, there are no reproductive links between them. There is no way that one of these roundworm parasites is going to be able to reproduce with another one and either produce some kind of new parasite or simply contribute to the continued life of one or the other of them. And this is still a problem for the evolutionist. The tempting answer would seem to be, well, there must have been a common ancestor for all the roundworms. And yet when you look at them, the hookworm and the pinworm and the human roundworm, the intestinal worm and the trichina worm that we talked about at some length, and the whipworm and filarial worm that causes elephantiasis, we'll talk about a little bit. It is apparent that even though there is the similarity in shape and body structure, similarities pretty much end at that point. And where they live in the body, how they're transmitted, the effects that they have inside the body, very, very different. So even though there is similarity, there certainly cannot be any kind of a genetic or reproductive relationship, and this is a problem for the evolutionists. If evolution is true, then we ought to be able to find common ancestors, organisms that are intermediate between one form of life and another. And as we've had occasion to observe often, it really doesn't matter where we look in the whole array of organisms, we really don't see that. If the evolutionist was correct, then we ought to, there really ought to be more common ancestors than there are real organisms. And if you'll recall when we talked about that, I made the comment that if evolution was true, it ought to mean that classification would be impossible. Because what we would find most of are organisms that are somehow intermediate between one kind of organism and another. And this whole series of programs that we've done, a number of them now, is simply dealing with the fact that there are these gaps. There are unbridgeable separations between organisms. And we've talked at great length about that. And I hope, partly as a result of our discussion of it, no one will underestimate the importance of that. There should be, if evolution is correct, a continuum of organisms going from some kind of unicellular organism up to folks or beyond, with thousands of developmental stages between each of those different kinds of organisms. And this is simply not what we find at all. We never find it. It's not that common ancestors are rare. They just don't exist. Now, if that bothers you, I would remind you that there were a series of programs where we talked about that at some length. And I read to you a comment by the curator of the British Museum of Natural History. It seems to me the figures there were something like 20,000 fossils they had out on the floor. And the man was asked if he could go out onto the floor and show the person who was asking the question one example of a common ancestor, an intermediate species, a missing link. And the man's forthright and correct answer was no. Now, if evolution is true, that's what we ought to find. And yet, as we have discussed all of these phyla, we don't ever find that. It's not that it's rare, it just doesn't exist. Now, at some point, without beating a dead horse, it ought to occur that if evolution is correct, these ought to be found. If they are not found, then this ought to suggest that there is something wrong with that view of nature. And because of that lack of support, it ought to cause some people to stop and be willing at least to recheck their presuppositions about the theory. Now, let's talk. One of the roundworms is very interesting to me that we've not talked about. There's one called Wuchereria bancrofti. I will not take time to spell it. If I told you, you wouldn't remember, and it's not particularly important. But this is a worm that is responsible for a condition known as elephantiasis, and it is particularly prevalent in the tropics. This is a mosquito-borne parasite, as I recall. And what happens is that you have a male and female roundworm that will mate in a lymph node. And as a result of that mating, microfilaria, very tiny, almost microscopic worms, are going to be produced, and there will be so many of them that they will actually block the lymph node. Now, I don't know how much you know about human anatomy, but there is a lymph circulation, and it is going mainly from the body tissues back toward the heart. So if you have a lymph node blocked up, and you have hundreds of these all over the body, if you have one that's blocked, then the lymph can't pass through the lymph node because of all the microfilaria that are there, and you begin to have the lymph that will accumulate in the tissue. If this occurs, for example, in a lymph node at the knee, then the lymph will begin to accumulate in the lower leg, and you have a person that has what looks like an elephant leg. It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. These can occur in reproductive organs. They can occur actually in any part of the body. They are not in themselves lethal, but you can imagine a person with horribly distended body parts is going to have a lot of difficulties. It's going to open them up to the possibility of injuries, of other parasites infecting the body and so on. And it is a very difficult condition. Unless something has happened in recent years, I'm not aware of any suitable chemical for this. Perhaps as good an attempt at prevention as any others trying to handle the mosquitoes. But if you've chosen to do away with insecticides, as some of our environmentalists have, then that takes away that possibility. And so far as I'm aware, there is not a chemical that is going to kill these parasites. And even if it did, once the microfilaria have begun to appear in the body, whether they're alive or dead really doesn't make much difference. They're still going to plug up the lymph gland, the lymph node, and you're going to have this accumulation of lymph in whatever body tissue is away from the heart toward the other part of the body. And you can go to most any, well, if those of you who know internet can go there and see pictures of this kind of thing if you're inclined to. What we've looked at are varieties of organisms, varieties of worms that are quite varied. We do not see the possibility of any common ancestors between them. We've seen that they live in different organisms. Their method of transportation is different. In some cases, it will be arthropods of some kind, mosquitoes. In some cases, the worms have the capability of simply chewing through the skin into the body tissue. With regard to almost any characteristic, you would see a wide variation. And there simply is not a defensible evolutionary answer to all the kinds of variety that we see. Excuse me. For this reason, I think it's important to look on these worms simply as another example of the fact that what we would expect to find if we were going to find support for the evolutionary theory is simply not what we see occurring in nature. And the not only is there not any evolutionist argument, which is generally agreed upon by the evolutionist, but there really is not even a basis for speculation that would incline one toward the view that all of these nematodes, which are parasites, let me stop for a moment. There are some nematodes that are free living. We don't usually give much thought to them because they're not of much consequence. There also are some nematodes that are plant parasites. And on occasion, these can be important. Tomatoes, for example, are one crop that can be interfered with because of the plant nematodes. But we have our discussion has been primarily about those that will affect humans or animals. And there simply is no way that a person can present any persuasive argument that all of these things have come from a single common ancestor. So we've looked now at a number of phyla, and every time we look at a new phylum, we see basically the same thing. We see great variety. We see a certain amount of similarities between the organisms, but it simply is not possible for there to be reproductive links with the other examples in whatever phylum we're talking about, the nematodes right now. Reproduction between the organism is simply not possible. And if that is not the case, then there has to be a completely different basis for the appearance of all of these kinds of worms. And as I have suggested repeatedly, the simple answer to this is we're looking here at an example of the variety which God chose to create. There is not a problem with this from a creationist standpoint. We may wonder why God chose to bring into existence those things that were going to be difficult, cause disease, etc. And I think the ultimate answer to that simply has to be a matter of sin. But we certainly do not see any kind of evidence, regardless of the phylum we've looked at, in which the evolutionist arguments find any kind of basis that would cause a person to accept that view as opposed to creation. And particularly for those of you that do not have much of a background in biology, I would suggest that you think this over, particularly for those of you that are believers. Now, you pick up the texts and you find this kind of thing all the time. And our young people are infused with it if they've gone to public school. They really have no basis sometimes to argue against it. It doesn't mean that it's the right answer. It just means that there is the necessity of some understanding about what we actually look at when we look at nature and understand that there is really no evidence here that would support the idea of macroevolution changes from one kind of organism to another.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson @bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.